Thank you so much for doing this again. I had to press the record button again, so I had to say thank you again. And I am glad that I'm getting to have this conversation with you, front row seats. I have a lot of questions. I've been listening to a lot of the podcasts you've been on. I've been reading a lot of your articles, and I think the way you think is fantastic. It's very enlightening for somebody who's interested in politics and other stuff that relates to India. I think I was reading some stuff about how Ladakh is, after a year of being a union territory, I think you'd written recently. And I think that's a very important question that you raised. And for that, thank you so much for doing such honest work.
Thank you, Prakhar.
How are you doing? How's your Sunday been?
Sunday was good, actually. It's very muggy and hot in India. As mm-hmm. you know, this is monsoon right. time, and it drizzled a little bit today. Mm-hmm. My dog and I went out for a bit. Right. We had a long walk. My help, she was cycling, so we had a good time.
Right. Cycling's really taken up in India, huh? Coronavirus mein. That's yes. really happened.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It is so interesting how we all have this passive desire that our modern lives don't equip us enough with, or equip us too much with, to live out.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, I have a different take on modernity, and people have this fascination, and also some people actually have an obsession to do it in the natural way, to go about life the way our ancestors did. You know, everything has to be organic, everything has to be natural. I am not in that category, actually. I tend to... I'm somebody who is more interested in advancement of technology and ease of life and convenience. I am not going to, you know, I'm not one of those champions of bicycling
right.
because at the end of the day, I know that, you know, in the profession that I am in, time matters, you know, speed right. matters. And everything cannot be about, you know, health and environment. So there has to be a balance between environment, your job, your duties, your obligations, your responsibilities, of course, as well. But the kind of, you know, insanity that is driving this entire, I call them social justice warriors,
right.
who think about nothing except the environment. If we were to think only about the environment, then I don't think humans would have made the progress that we have. You know, society wouldn't have built the kind of, you know, infrastructure that we have built, whether it's in the US or now in India, we are trying to catch up. But essentially, you know, at the end of the day, life is about making it more convenient and making it happier for everyone.
You're right. And, you know, I mean, my instinctive guess when you started saying that was to wonder if this opinion has something to do with you living in America for a little bit, going to Colombia. Because when Abhijit told me you were at Colombia, I was like, oh my gosh, look at that.
Yes.
Because 3 years of being here, it is almost undeniable how much technology, rule of law, social contract, stuff that is progress, that is away from the natural, organic, you know, domain of things has helped humans progress. It is pretty evident. How was your experience?
One of my favorite pastimes in New York used to be, you know, sit in the balcony for hours together while I was looking for jobs in New York after my graduation at Columbia.
Right.
It was to look at the skyline, the Manhattan skyline. You know, we had... we used to live right across the river, the Hudson River, mm-hmm. and I had the entire Manhattan skyline as my, you know, balcony view.
So you were living across the river then, Jersey, Maine?
Yes.
Right.
I was in Long Island City, uh-huh. which is, you know, one stop after Grand Central.
Right.
So I used to have that entire Manhattan skyline as my window view. And I would often wonder, you know, the potential humans have, the potential human societies have to build the kind of magnificent jungle, concrete jungle, as we call it, that they have built in New York City. You know, that's when you understand and ran. That's when you understand Atlas Shrugged. That's when you understand Fountainhead. You know, that humans have capabilities and potential to do much more than any other species in the entire, you know, in the entire world.
Right.
So when you say, you know, Columbia University, yes, you know, Columbia University humanities section, of course, they promote postmodernism in a way that, you know, it has taken away all the enjoyment or taken away all the pride and a sense of accomplishment that humans used to have, say the baby boomers used to have. That has gone away. Now, most of the humanities, in fact, in most of the Ivy Leagues in the US, they pour scorn on modernity. They pour scorn on modernization, scorn on whatever human societies have built after the Renaissance in Europe, for example. You know, it took human societies so much, whether it was Galileo or, you know, Copernicus, you know, in their own time, it took them so much to fight the church, to fight conservatism. And now we have the left, which calls itself left, but it has all the characteristics of being conservative. So essentially, you know, there is no sense of accomplishment for the technology that we have produced. There is contempt for whatever, you know, whatever humans have made, because there was a drive to struggle and to create a better world. From that, I mean, advancement in medicine, advancement in technology, advancement even in education, in every sphere of life. So Columbia, you know, on the one hand, yes, you know, I had all these friends who were completely into social justice, you know, warrior syndrome. And there were, but there was also an internal debate, you know, going on. I don't know whether it's still going on in Columbia as of today, but 10 years ago, there was a very intellectually stimulating debate going on among the academics at Columbia. I remember that, you know, I did master's in international affairs and with a focus on economic policy. But the classes that I took were, you know, also on diplomacy and international, you know, relations. And I remember within the academia in Colombia, there were two clear sides. There was this side, you know, to which I think I belong. And I think that is the classical liberal, you know, thinking. And then there was this completely loony left academia within Colombia's larger academic circle, who were promoting the whole the same postmodernism that came from Europe in the 60s. And were, I could also see that students were divided along these two different schools of thinking. I don't know if Columbia has moved on from that debate, whether that debate has been settled, whether they have finally figured out where the Western civilization needs to go, or whether they're still stuck in the kind of debates that I was witness to.
It is the debates are of a nature that corrupt the premises from the inside, and I don't think they've disappeared. I think they've only tilted in the favor of the postmodernists a lot more. So I started at Columbia 2017, and I mean, I'm a kid from Delhi. What do I know, right? So I'm just walking around.
I'm a girl. I'm a small town girl. I was a refugee in my own country. Right. I, you know, was a destitute in many ways. I came from nowhere and nothing, and it was just, you know, my good luck and probably my, well, I should say that my hard work as well, that I got to Colombia.
Right.
Yeah. That I had a very different impression in my mind about the US before I, you know, arrived there. I had a different idea of, Western academia. And when I finally arrived there and when I became part of that elite club, in fact, in the orientation itself, they tell you that, you know, you are the elite because right. you are studying among the best in the world. You are being taught by the best in the world. And I realized that there were many things which were illuminating, which really opened my eyes, which really made me think. And then there were certain things which were really disappointing. For example, there was one occasion when this right-wing European parliamentarian, Geert Wilders, he wanted to come to Colombia for a lecture. And there were protests, you know, there was a boycott call by several students' unions. And who was leading the charge for boycott of his lecture were Islamic, Muslim students' union. And it was very disappointing because at Colombia, I mean, in all Western, in all American universities, the idea of free speech and expression is supreme, you know. That is something that you do not deny to anyone. But there was a boycott call by students and students didn't turn up. In fact, there was so much anger and outrage over his visit that the university almost shut that day. My friend and I, we went and we attended his lecture, and then there were some of the students of the Muslim student union who had come, and they booed and they were almost heckling him. And that was very disappointing because I had not thought, I had not imagined that if something like that would happen at Colombia. And now you are telling me that, you know, the debate is more tilted in favor of those elements. That's really disappointing.
I'm glad to be the bringer of good news to you. But I have been through something like this myself. So like I said, no, I was just a Delhi boy. I had no idea. I was 21 when I moved here, right? I was doing my undergrad. And I had no idea of the grander rules that govern this land space, right? Like the rules around speech are very interesting. So America is a land of free speech, but there are certain words that you dare not utter at all. And so those things were a little hard for me to come around, at least psychologically speaking. And I made the mistake often of thinking out loud, of experimenting with my geography, of being in rooms I should not be in to acquire. And isn't that what the university is meant for? So to add to this instance that you're saying, very recently, a gentleman named, and this has been 3 years of recency, a gentleman named Mike Cernovich, I don't know if you've heard of his name. He was on Columbia's campus. And he is, let's say he's one of those people who does not believe in the institutional means of information dissemination as much. And he's some sort of an independent journalist, commentator kind of a figure on Twitter, right? He's known as alt-right, whatnot. And so I had a couple of friends who were sitting in that event. They were there to listen to him. And while they were walking out, they weren't just heckled by people who were boycotting. It wasn't just Cernovich who was heckled. These people were called racists. These people were called names. And that evening, I still remember my friend came back home. He was my roommate back then. We sat down and we decided this is enough. Both of us were Indians. He's Indian from California. I'm Indian from India. And we were like, you know what? We need to start a free speech club. And it became such a running joke that there were two Indian guys who were arguing for free speech on Columbia's campus. And then this club, it became a thing on its own, all that. But the point was that room there where we would meet to discuss these controversial issues was supposed to remain locked, lest people who were not supposed to walk in walked in and we were in somebody's front headlines tomorrow. Because there was a lot of that as well. So Columbia, in a very grand sense, majorly has moved to adopt this left-leaning postmodernist cultural Marxist where, you know, pride has been replaced by guilt and everybody loathes and shames themselves. And it's vaguely similar. It's nostalgic to me because I repeat this often on my podcast too. I grew up with the same sense of self-loathe being an Indian, being a Hindu. And I don't know how it looks like for somebody like you, somebody, you know, who's been a refugee in their own country. I'm sure the identity equation is a little different.
It is different, but not, I can relate to what you just said, you know, that this self-hatred, this shame in being an Indian, shame in being a Hindu. For the longest time, you know, after we became refugees, I tried to understand what had happened to us. I tried to understand because I was a curious kid, you know, some things are innate to you. So I started reading up, and I wanted to be a journalist because of the circumstances in which we got displaced. Suddenly, you know, from army school, I was in a public school, not even public school. I mean, it was nothing. So my life had, it had turned upside down, and I wanted to understand what had happened to us. So I started reading, and I had a fair sense of history before I became a journalist. And when I went back to Kashmir as a journalist, you know, I had read up things, but the way narrative had been built, not just in Kashmir, but in Delhi, because I was working, I went back as a journalist for a national newspaper. So, but I could see that, you know, the narrative in Kashmir was in sync with the narrative in Delhi. In that frame, my narrative as a displaced Kashmiri Pandit was non-existent. Hmm. So I had several dilemmas. I had several conflicts. I was torn. I had a severe identity crisis. I think I still have, to a large extent, an identity crisis, because when I went back as a journalist to Kashmir after 12 years, I had left when I was a kid of 8th standard. I went back as, I think, the youngest displaced Kashmiri Pandit journalist to go back. And I think I was the only woman, displaced Kashmiri Pandit woman, in Kashmir when I went back. So, and I realized that, you know, my own experience as a displaced Kashmiri Pandit, my own memories of what had happened in the 80s in Kashmir, my own memory of how we were driven out of Kashmir, my own identity was completely missing from the entire public discourse on Kashmir. So when I went back as a journalist, I could not relate to the place to begin with, because the place had Islamized in those 12 years drastically. It was no longer the syncretic Kashmir that, you know, I was born in and then I was raised in. Now, many people are going to, you know, say that Kashmir had communal issues. Yes, Kashmir had communal issues. Kashmir had a certain history of, unrest. Because not just unrest, but also tensions. Because you see, Kashmir was not untouched by the politics of pre-independence India or pre-partition India. It was also, you know, why do we often hear Kashmiri separatists or many politicians saying, or I mean, Pakistan has been constantly saying that Kashmir is the unfinished business of the partition. Because Kashmir was part of that partition politics. The whole idea was that, you know, Muslims cannot live with Hindus. That was the call. That was the cry for the two Muslim theory, two nation theory. And when I went back, I could not relate to that place, because Pakistan, which had been Islamized in the 70s, first by Bhutto and then rapidly Islamized by Ziaul Haq, Kashmir was Islamized in the late 80s, I would say, but nobody really paid attention to what was happening. And 90s, of course, you know, it was rapid. And 2000s further Islamized. In fact, I would say Wahhabized. So I couldn't relate to that place. Jammu, where I was, you know, raised after displacement, which is after 1990. Again, I couldn't relate to that place because Jammu is ethnically different, linguistically different, culturally different from Kashmir. And then much later, you know, of course, I went to the US and then I came to Delhi from US. So I don't really relate to, I don't think, you know, Delhi is my home. Delhi is where I have now settled down as a professional, but there is no cultural root.
Connect, right.
There is no ethnic connect. There is no linguistic connect. Even though, you know, you can speak in English and Hindi, but when you have Bengali people, you know, coming together, they speak in Bengali. So you understand that there is something that binds them, you know, even though being in working in Delhi, they remain Bengali in many ways. So for me, there is an identity crisis. What you made a very important point about the self-loathing, you know, the self-hatred. And I don't think it is only because the narrative in Kashmir and the narrative in Delhi about Kashmir was the same. I think it had there was something else to this whole self-loathing that I felt. And I think that comes from, the education that, you know, we all were brought up in, I don't know, I'm basically a late 70s kid, and we all studied NCERT books. We all went to similar schools with similar educational, module.
Right.
And in that education, you know, I think what we often don't understand while we are, you know, kids, while we are in school, while we are in college, how we were brainwashed to think in a certain way. And this awareness doesn't come until, you know, I don't know, maybe you became aware about it earlier than I did. But for me, that awareness did not come until I went to the US. And it became clear only in the last 10 years to me, because mainstream media in Delhi has its own challenges, has its own problems. And you can see, you know, the way mainstream media has been at the receiving end of what we call alt media. You have clear divisions within the media. But what I'm essentially saying is that education is part of that self-loathing that we all were raised in.
Absolutely.
Because we were never made to feel proud of who we are as people, who we are as a civilization, who we are as, you know, as a cultural continuum or as a cultural community.
I agree.
I think this is particularly a post 1990 phenomenon. I don't think it is. I think till Indira Gandhi was alive, there was a sense of immense pride, among Indians of that generation. To, you know, if you talk to your parents, if you talk to your cousins who were older to you, they have a very clear understanding of who they are, that they are Indians and they are proud of being Indians. But there was something really happened after Indira Gandhi's, killing, when Rajiv Gandhi took over. The entire coterie he was surrounded by were westernized, who were westernized in post-modernistic thinking, wherein everything was being questioned, that, why do we need to take pride in who we are?
Right.
You know, that was one of the questions.
Right.
And that thinking got inculcated in our generation because we were kids, we were teenagers, you know, when this whole new culture, this post-modernistic culture arrived in India. And along with that happened globalization, you know. India opened up. When India opened up, we obviously brought in the Western thinking in almost all the institutions. This whole idea of, you know, human rights violations. A terrorist, for example, has more human rights than a victim of terror.
Right.
You know, in many, many cases.
Situations, right, right.
Yeah.
No.
So this loathing that you're talking about, I have felt it. And it was only, I think, if you really ask me honestly, 2016 was it was a turning point in my life for many reasons. But 2016 got me a certain understanding and got me a certain clarity about what we were fighting against.
Why is 2016? I will come to that. Why is 2016 so important?
Yes, well, 2016, because a few things had happened. So till 2000, you know, in 2014 parliamentary elections, I was completely, I would say, I'd become irrational, you know, irrational to the extent that though I call myself a rationalist and I'm an atheist, I am a skeptic. And it's innate to me. I didn't have to, you know, get indoctrinated in Marxism to become an atheist.
Right.
My atheism comes from the rational school of thinking. I was a Bertrand Russell fan. And I've been, yeah. I can say that I was left liberal. At that point, I did not realize that I was left liberal. But when I look back, I realize that I was left liberal because all I had read about, you know, Prime Minister Modi was Tehelka magazine, you know, stories. All I had read about BJP and RSS was the point of view that came from the left media, that came from left academics. I had not read the other side. So there was, that is not neutral. That is not being balanced. That is being prejudiced. So I was prejudiced against the right wing. I used to think that right wing is stupid, you know. So I had all those notions, which I think, you know, when I look back, I really feel that that was irrational. But in 2016, I decided I came back to Delhi in 2010 ending, and I joined as an editor in Times of India in Delhi. My previous experience before going to the US was in the field as a field reporter, as a field journalist. So this was my first, first stint as an editor in Delhi. Which I liked, which I enjoyed. It gave me an advantage in many ways, and I learned a lot as an editor. I understood Delhi and Indian politics in a much better way than I used to.
Right.
But 2016, I decided that I want to go back to field. In 2016, there was a violent crisis in Kashmir, so I went back. And the ground had shifted enormously from the time, you know, I had been as a full-time field journalist in JNK. And it opened my eyes once again, because I had now come back equipped with educational skills, you know, everything that I needed to know in international relations terms, in terms of you know, economy, the economic forces behind the conflict. So everything that I did not know before going to Colombia, I now knew, and I went back to the field with different skills, with different knowledge, with different perceptions, and also with my editorial understanding and editorial skills. So I decided that So I understood that there was something sinister had happened, and this was a different, I mean, I had seen the worst in J&K in 89-90 as a Kashmiri Pandit. Then I went back after 12 years as a young journalist, and then kept going back repeatedly. You know, I used to go regularly. And then when I went to the US, there was only once between that time I went back to Kashmir. And in 2016, although in between I went back, but not as a journalist, as a field journalist. You know, I went for other things. I wanted to do some research on a few things. But as a journalist, you know, I could see that the ground had shifted, that the state had actually, state had not collapsed the way it had collapsed in 1990, but the state was under an influence which was detrimental to its own interests. So I came back with a different thinking altogether. That is why I said 2016. Till 2014, I think I was immensely prejudiced against one side.
Right.
So 2015 changed me a little bit, because after Modi became the prime minister, I started reading, you know, their point of view also, started reading the RSS point of view, the BJP point of view, and also some of the work that had been done on Gujarat 2002 riots. So, and I realized that, you know, I did not know enough to have an opinion, which I had formulated just because, you know, I had read Times of India reports or HD reports or Tehelka reports and watched NDTV, you know, day and night during 2002.
Right. Yeah. Tell me, this transition that happened for you, you seem to remember it clearly enough, because it's a very interesting transition. I, for one, I do not publicly, at least on the platform and such, tell people what my politics is, partly because I want to reserve it from the public. So I have the option enough to change it often enough. And it does. You know, I'll speak to you, I'll speak to Abhijit, and then maybe I'll speak to somebody who's, it's like Abhinandan, right? Abhinandan Sekri. And I'll let that simmer. It'll create a new thought process in my mind. But I often wonder, this transition from, say, left to right or right to left, stuff that you don't usually often see people admitting openly. What is it made out of? Is it like new facts get acquired, or is it like a perspective shift? Like, I look at things differently, the same facts are interpreted differently. What really happens? Why is it that we don't see the same elephant in the room when I'm talking to somebody who's on the opposite side of the political spectrum?
Okay, so I think I was never a Marxist. I was never a communist. And there are reasons why I have never been a communist and a Marxist. And the biggest reason is that we got displaced in 1990. So my childhood was very different from the childhood most kids experience in India. So when you really have to struggle for existence, communism is not what strikes you.
Right.
Marxism is not what strikes you. You don't really feel, because as a displaced Kashmiri Pandit, I did not feel a class connection with, say the migrants of, for example, the migrants of Chhattisgarh who were working in Jammu. There was no connection in that sense. There was a strong sense of, you know, injustice for sure. And it came from the fact that, you know, we were targeted because we were Hindus. So this much was real. This much was, you know, clear to me that more than the class, it is the religious identity that was at the heart of of our displacement. So I could not connect to the same, you know, my family was in a refugee camp. So their status economically or financially was not better than the Jugi Jopdi wala migrant from Chhattisgarh or Bihar or UP. So financially they were the same. But there was no emotional connect. I couldn't relate to what they were, you know, what they used to think because our history and context of displacement and our financial situation was in a different setting altogether. One of my relatives was targeted because he was associated with the RSS. My family used to run a business, a small business, which was essentially, we were the distributors of newspapers, magazines, we also, you know, in those times, I think, you know, you probably don't know, there used to be something called, you know, you would rent, you would give VHS tapes on rent, and video players on rent. So we were in a way, in 89, when the Islamist terror groups were rampant and on a rampage to kill people, to kill everything that was un-Islamic, we were their main targets in Kashmir, because we were corrupting the Muslim society by bringing in Indian magazines, Indian newspapers, Bollywood movies, Hollywood movies. So we were threatened. We were asked to shut our business. And then, of course, you know, on January 1990, we heard slogans, Nizam-e-Mustafa. We heard, not just on January 1990, but before that, we heard slogans, you know, yahan, you know, kya chalega Nizam-e-Mustafa, and then, you know, we will keep Kashmiri Pandit women, but we will kill Kashmiri Pandit men. So all those religious fundamentalist slogans were part of the jihad that drove us out. So I was never a Marxist. But I, as I said earlier, you know, the education was such, our history, our social sciences were such, and the syllabus and the course was such that we were made to think that we're not something great, you know, we're not a great civilization. The great civilizations are Western civilizations, you know, Europeans are great, Americans are great, even Chinese are great. But India doesn't have, India has been a poor country. That was the narrative in, 80s and 90s, of course, until economic liberalization transformed the country.
Economic situation, right.
Yeah,
right.
The country. So we were poor, we were backward, we were primitive. We had nothing to feel great about, nothing to be proud of. And also, if you remember 1990, there was an economic crisis for India, balance of payment crisis.
Right.
Then we had a coalition era, so there was political instability.
Right.
India was at its weakest. So there was Mandal Commission riots. There was then Babri Masjid riots. There were Mumbai riots. So all you had was bad news in India. That is the kind of India that we grew up in. So everything was bad. Now, so that sense of civilization wasn't there at all. And of course, you know, the way political science and history was taught, we were not supposed to feel great about, for example, Kashmiri community. There was nothing about Kashmiri community, Kashmiri Pandit community. We did not hear anything about Lalita Ditya, Abhinav Gupt, our warrior queens, Queen Didda, or Kota Rani. Nothing, you know. We didn't hear anything. Anything that, you know, made you feel proud of India.
Right.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that the transformation, when I'm saying that I was left liberal, this realization happened only after 2014. Until that moment, I used to take offense when people used to say that, you know, you are a lefty. you're a leftist. And I used to say that I have not been a Marxist, I'm not a communist. And also remember that USSR disintegrated in our time when we were in school in 1990, right?
Mm-hmm.
So disintegration, so there was nothing about communism or Marxism which was appealing to my generation because I had so much baggage and right. also history.
Right.
Then, but the narrative is important. Because who was determining the narrative? The narrative was being determined by your TV channels. Mm-hmm. The new media that mushroomed in our time was these, you know, new channels came up because India opened up. There was economic liberalization. We had NDTV. And I remember I was glued to NDTV day in, day out.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up watching Barkha Dutt day in, day out.
Hmm.
You know, all of them, you know, Vikram Chandra and Rajdeep Sardesai,
hmm.
they were the idols. And whatever they were feeding us, that was the ultimate truth. And for a certain period, when I told you now that I went back to Kashmir after a gap of 12 years,
hmm.
I realized that whatever narrative was being peddled in Delhi by NDTV or by any of these English medium channels, that was the same narrative that was being propagated, created, generated by separatists in Kashmir.
Hmm.
So the narrative was in sync. For me, that became clear only after I went to the US and I came back to India from the right. US.
Hmm.
My transformation from, you know, being a Modi basher to now looking at his policies, I don't really, now the kind of hysteria, the kind of hate mongering people do in his name, I stopped doing that because I realized that, you know, I have to look at what he's really saying
hmm.
and what he's really doing.
Hmm.
If he's doing exactly what I would have liked to do in Kashmir, then I'm going to support that
right.
policy. It is not about the person.
Hmm.
It is about what is being done on the ground.
Right.
So I admit this transformation because in media, I have to say that media is as corrupt as any other industry.
Mm.
Okay. And in media, the vested interests are aligned one way or the other way. And I think, you can call it fortunately or unfortunately,
hmm.
But because I have been a journalist from the field who has had no patronage, who has had no influence because I had no, patrons. I have no influential background. I come with no connections. I come from a very, very modest family. I worked hard in life. I slogged in life to make it to this point.
Right.
Many people may think that this is nothing, but given the fact that, you know, we were on the streets, we had nothing, it's still, I think, I would say some journey for me.
Hmm.
And when I, since I did not come from any of the cliques and any of the influential families or any with no patronage, I had the fortune, I would say, that I was able to see both sides playing out within media.
Hmm.
I could see what was happening in the big media organizations. I could see who was taking whose side, depending on what was at stake. And, as I said, media is as corrupt as any other industry, so I think I remained untouched from that.
Mm.
In many ways, I think I remained innocent because I was not part of anything.
Mm.
I didn't have the background.
let me try and make my question a little sharper, because you, what you answered totally does the job, but I have one lingering doubt that I think I'll be able to resolve. So what usually happens in the modern, and I, by modern, I mean 2020 political discussion, is that we'll be looking at the same thing, you and I. We'll be looking at Ram Janam Bhoomi Pujan, right? We'll be looking at that. And I will, both of us will bring two very different articles to the table. One of them will say, finally, ab agla Kashi hai, agla Mathura hai, we are on our way. And then somebody will say, Ram, I am not going to find you in Ayodhya. I'm not going to find you there. And so it's the same fact. It's the same thing has happened. But it, those, there is no way I can put those two texts in conversation. They seem to be looking at two absolutely different things. And I often wonder, and I've addressed it with a few journalists already on the podcast, is why is it that these two narratives seem like they're talking about two absolutely distinct things for somebody who's not been to Kashmir, for somebody who does not have the means, access, time, resources, whatever, to look at what is happening on the ground. Agar kalko, my dad is of a different political opinion, I'm of a different political opinion, we can't sit in the same room. We're not looking at reality the same. And that is what I wanted to ask when I meant with the transition, is that what is this difference between me and this hypothetical other, such that we cannot even look at the same thing when we talk about it?
Okay, I think I understand your point. Well, I have to say that there has never been, a neutral media. This realization came to me way late in life. I joined journalism with a lot of idealism. I wanted to uncover the truth. I wanted to fight for people who have been wronged. It didn't matter to me whether, you know, it's a Kashmiri Muslim or a Kashmiri Pandit. Every time I went to Kashmir, you know, I used to have this bleeding heart for people who were tormented and persecuted by the state in one or the other way. There were human rights violations. But was that the only reality? No, it wasn't. The larger reality was that Pakistan-sponsored terror groups were the biggest oppressors and the biggest persecutors of common Kashmiri Muslims. But that reality was completely concealed. That's why I kept saying the narrative. That reality was camouflaged. Nobody wanted to talk about the militants because there's a vested interest, right?
What is it?
I'm getting
right,
there.
Right.
There was a section of bureaucracy, a section of politicians, a section of media, who minted money, who assumed power by propagating this whole machinery, which was anti-India. You know, because for the longest time, one has to really laugh about it. India's major policy in Kashmir regarding the conflict, regarding terrorism in Kashmir, was that bribe the separatists, you know, buy out the people who are making noise. And that itself created an incentivization of terror, you know, incentivization of separatism in Kashmir, incentivization of pro-Pakistan lobby in Kashmir. Now, coming to what you're asking me, that these two narratives are completely different. People, it seems that people cannot even sit together and talk. You're right. And the reason for that is that in 2014, something phenomenal happened in India. Till 2014, one would ask this question that, you know, it's not only been the Gandhis who have ruled India. There was a coalition era. But as we know, coalition era was the instability period, instability era of, India. That instability created havoc for India. And I think at some point, overall political parties understood this, that unstable coalitions will not work. That's why, Vajpayee, who who's praised by everyone is praised because he was able to carry everyone along and he was able to show that coalitions can be stable. So because there was a certain consensus about having stable governments, because unstable governments do not help democracies.
Right.
Now, the pre-2014 era in India was essentially the Gandhi era. And for the longest time, India has been ruled by the Gandhi dynasty in one or the other way. Whether it was, you know, supporting some coalitions outside the government or inside the government, and sometimes, you know, leading the government. So it was the Gandhis who were at the helm. 2014, a person who came from nowhere, who whom they scorn and have contempt for because he's supposedly a chaiwala, he made it to the most powerful club of India, which is Parliament. And he made it to the top position. He became the Prime Minister. That Darbar, essentially, the post-colonial Darbar, which was set up after the British left, after, you know, so Nehru took over from the British, the entire bureaucracy that we inherited from from the Brits was influenced by the colonial thinking. The political system, the entire politics we had learned from the Brits. The entire statecraft we had learned from the colonial powers.
Right.
So 2014, that colonial thinking ended. And a local and you can say
indigenous,
the traditional, the indigenous, the traditional thinking assumed power. And that is why there's been so much, you know, resentment, outrage, so much animosity, because not only has the so-called liberal thinking being supplanted by the traditional, the Western thinking supplanted by the traditional indigenous thinking, but the elite has also been supplanted by
the common man,
the downtrodden, the common man, the common Indian. So that is why somebody, you know, who studied in English medium school, who went to fancy colleges, who has a different lifestyle and different yardstick and different prism to look at the reality, to look at the world. He will not sit in the same room as somebody who's come from the streets. That is why I have also felt an outsider, you know. Remember I told you earlier that I couldn't relate to the migrant class, because we were refugees. So there's a difference between a migrant and a refugee. But I can't also relate to this, to this class, despite the fact that, you know, I'm a salaried class person. I have a decent lifestyle, way more than the average Indian. But I cannot relate to the elite of Delhi. Because I come from a different background. I come from a different class. I come from a different identity. I come from a different tradition. So I may be educated in the same lexicon as they are, but I'm not them. I'm not, I don't belong to that club. So that is why, that is why somebody who is hailing, this Ayodhya, you know, Janambu, this puja that we did. He will not be able to connect to the person who has been indoctrinated in the thinking that religion is not important to us. You know, we are all, we are secular. And of unfortunately, the definition of secularism in India was that Hindus are supposed to feel ashamed about their religion, to right. feel not just ashamed about their religion, but Hindus must hide their religion. They shouldn't wear it on their sleeves, but everybody else, the minorities are entitled to wear it on their sleeves, but the majority is not.
Right.
So that is why these two narratives cannot come together. They are, as I said, the narrative that is clashing with the right, so to say, right-wing Hindu narrative today is the narrative which has been shaped and informed and influenced by postmodernism of Europe and not necessarily classical liberalism. I think there would have been, you know, think about this, that there was a conservative strain within the Congress party always. Many people say that Sardar Patel was a conservative and Nehru was a liberal, left liberal, but they worked together. They were they made India, they are the modern architects of modern India. They work together. So how did that happen? That is not going to happen today because your new liberal in India is not really a classical liberal. I think in many ways Nehru was not, you know, he would be shocked to see the kind of liberalism that is being propagated in his name today,
right.
because this is not what Nehru was, or even Indira was.
Right.
They were liberals of the older kind, the traditional kind, the classical kind. This liberalism is entirely postmodernistic.
You know, it is very interesting to me that the Pakistani population is more ready to accept that they were being controlled by the elite class, because I think South Asia, once the British left, became a very, very classist society. And it happened almost organically, given only some people had the means and some people had the means to govern. Pakistanis are more ready to accept that, you know, Zia-ul-Huq so-and-so, a Bhutto family so-and-so, than Indians accept that the Gandhi dynasty was, you know, sitting on top of us and dictating how things should be. And part of it is probably a realization that came to me once I got here, when I had a comparative coordinate, once I'd been in America and I was pushed against the wall to accept myself or be walked all over by people from all parts of the world. I was forced to accept the fact, firstly, that I'm Indian, that I speak in Hindi, and I should be proud of the fact that I speak in Hindi. And as far as education goes and how education creates a sort of a self-alienated sense of being, I think English plays such a massive part in that process. When the medium of official instruction, everywhere where you're supposed to do professional, good, fancy, you know, like formal things, is supposed to happen in a language I am not well-versed in at all, I have automatically alienated myself to feel like I'm not good enough. And I think a lot of people from my generation, at least a lot of people I know, who come to schools like Columbia, freshmen, you see Indian freshmen, they're so afraid. They're just so massively afraid of being put out in the open for that very reason, because a lot of it has to do with the sense of identity. But I want to ask you some of the more interesting questions, that because when you said something along the lines of that the first approach we had to separatists in Kashmir was to bribe them, and it is laughable, but it also is worthy enough of skepticism. Where, I mean, if a Pakistani was telling me that, I would believe his skepticism. You were bribing the separatists. You didn't want the separation to happen. You know, as far as narratives go, if I'm only to hear the narrative of the opposite side, this fact can be very well placed in their narrative to make sense of their narrative too. And my question is, I was listening to your podcast with Shyam, I think, and you were talking about how Stand With Kashmir, one of the most prominent social media platforms right now that fights for Kashmir, is basically funded by Pakistan or something along those lines. I don't want to misquote you. I see it all over my Instagram. I see it all over. Everybody's sharing a Stand With Kashmir montage of 1 year since Kashmir has gone down, XYZ, ABC. And I'm just curious, what is happening? How is it? Who's funding Stand With Kashmir? Are they telling the truth? Are they telling a lie? What are the interests? What is the matrix of that?
See, Stand With Kashmir, it's a bunch of academics, a bunch of journalists, a bunch of artists who've come together, and they are mostly, they are a group of, I mean, all these professionals who have come together, and they come from India and they come from Pakistan. So they are diaspora as well as people who are sitting here in India and Pakistan. And who are they? What is their aim? What is their objective? Their objective is Jammu and Kashmir. Actually, now Jammu has been Jammu. They don't include. They want Kashmir's separation from India, Kashmir's secession from India. And what is their, on what basis are they seeking Kashmir's independence from India? They're seeking this on the basis that India, you know, they have various. For example, Kashmiri separatists for a long time said Nehru had promised plebiscite for Jammu and Kashmir, the right to self-determination.
Right.
And that was not fulfilled. But they quote UN resolutions again, saying that, you know, there was the UN resolutions granted right to self-determination. There was going to be a referendum. Mm. Except that they forget that the UN resolutions, in UN resolutions, one, the primary condition for a referendum was that Pakistan had to withdraw from the areas which it occupied in 1947. Hmm. Since Pakistan did not fulfill that condition, there was no referendum. So on that basis, and then they also claim that, you know, India has been an oppressor of Kashmiri Muslims in the last 30 years. But nobody, none of them will tell their audience in the West or on social media that till 1987, till that elections in which rigging happened, and then we saw this phase of the violent terrorism in Kashmir. Till that moment, there was no such thing as independence. Everyone, in fact, wanted wanted to be part of, whosoever was involved with separatism wanted Jammu and Kashmir to be part of Pakistan based on two nation theory, as I said earlier, because Jammu and Kashmir is a Muslim majority state. And Kashmir has is almost homogeneously Muslim. They ought to have been part of Pakistan, which was a state created in the name of Islam and a state created for Muslims. Because the whole concept of two-nation theory was that Muslims cannot coexist with Hindus and they deserve to have their own state. Now, this entire, after 9-11, after 9-11, separatists in Kashmir, and of course they were funded, they've been funded by the ISI for decades, they decided that, you know, Islamist terrorism is making this whole thing look really bad. And if you remember, after 9-11, George Bush, you know, declared war against terrorism, which essentially meant Islamist terrorism, which was being nurtured and created in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So since 9-11, the narrative was deliberately changed by the Pakistan's ISI and Kashmiri separatists that this is a freedom struggle, that this struggle is for Kashmir's independence from both India and Pakistan. Until 9-11, it was nothing, you know, like independence. So independence became the new mantra, the new slogan for every separatist, every, you know, every, not just separatists, but also human rights activists in in Kashmir.
Right.
So who were these human rights activists? Human rights activists were, of course, funded again by the leftist groups in Europe, in the West. A lot of funding came from Europe. A lot of funding also came from Middle East, from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, from Turkey. So you saw this, this new generation coming up, saying that, we need to now package this entire narrative in the Marxist paradigm, in the Marxist language. So they applied all the postmodernistic theories to a religious conflict. Essentially, Kashmir is a religious conflict. It is a communal conflict. It is based, it comes, the genesis of the conflict is in two nation theory. It is in the communal division, communal partition of India. And the creation of Pakistan, which was an Islamic state and is an Islamic state. But this packaging was done by the academia, by all these human rights activists, by the journalists, by the media, who were, again, as I said earlier, the postmodernistic influence on Indian media, English-speaking media, after economic liberalization, connected with media in Kashmir, who were essentially Islamists, but then started projecting themselves as, secular and leftist. So Stand With Kashmir is that lobby, which is now, I think a huge section of it is based in the US. And they are running these platforms on social media. And it happened, it started, in fact, my friend and I, a Kashmiri Muslim friend of mine and I, we started a group several years, in fact, 10 years ago. And we called it Moderate Voice of Jammu, Kashmir and Ladakh. And our whole mission in that, social media platform was to encourage critical thinking, to encourage skepticism, and to encourage point of view which was not dominant. So at that point, 10 years ago, we were the alt view,
right.
So and what were we doing? We were questioning these narratives. We were questioning the Islamist terrorism in Kashmir. We were questioning Pakistan's role in Kashmir. We were questioning this entire lobby, the left and Islamist nexus, which had come to propagate the same view that Pakistan has on Kashmir. And we noticed that, it created a reaction. We suddenly saw a new group emerged, and it was called Kashmir Solidarity Network. That Kashmir Solidarity Network has now become Stand With Kashmir. It has the same members who've been running social media propaganda which suits Pakistan more than anyone else. And they are the ones who are pushing this line that, India is the oppressor, whereas the fact is it is Pakistan-sponsored terrorists who have been persecuting and who've been killing Kashmiri Muslims the most.
That's a new piece of information, the fact that there has been more... if somebody had to look that up, because that, stuff like this changes the balance of scales very heavily. If we were to say that, Islamic terrorists from Pakistan are killing Kashmiri Muslims, where would somebody look up information like that? How would I find that out?
Well, it's very clear. The fact that Lashkar-e-Taiba, for example, it's based in Pakistan. Who is running it? Hafiz Saeed, a Pakistani national. Jaish-e-Mohammed, Masood Azhar heads that organization. He's based in Pakistan. Hizbul Mujahideen, again, headed by Saeed Salahuddin, based in Pakistan. All the three major terror groups which are operating in Kashmir against India are based in Pakistan. The number of terrorists who've been pushed and infiltrated into Jammu and Kashmir in the last 30 years is public knowledge. You can look it up at on any of the say US State Department website, CIA website. You can check this on SATP.org. You can read dozens and dozens of books which have been written in the last 30 years about Pakistan. In fact, Pakistani authors themselves have written about the this whole project of Kashmir, the jihad in Kashmir, which was started by Ziaul Haq, General Ziaul Haq, in around 1980. And this happened after 1971 war with India when Bangladesh was created. So Hussain Haqqani, for example, has written several books on Pakistan army and its projects, including cross-border terror in J&K. Arif Jamal has written a brilliant book called, Arif Jamal is a Pakistani who wrote a book called Shadow War on Kashmir, and how he explains how Hizbul Mujahideen was nurtured by Jamaat-e-Islami organization, which is based in Pakistan and which has a branch in Kashmir. Hizbul Mujahideen is their militant, their terror wing. So this is public knowledge. And if this was not public knowledge, these three terror groups would not have been banned by the UN and banned by the US and by UK and by other countries. So nothing is, you know, is
personal opinion.
Right. Yeah, it is a fact. These are facts.
My, you know, it just strikes me, the fact that there is such obviousness that Pakistan's involved. In fact, most of my Pakistani friends don't even hide from it. Like, unlike India's common population that probably does not know this, Pakistan's population is like, yeah, we fund terrorism in Kashmir. And there is this kind of like a weird smile about it, like a passive smile about it too. But I think it's partly because they're very proud of their military. Their army is something that the Pakistani population is extremely proud of. The one institution that's overperforming in the entire country. But it is so funny to me, when there is such obvious interference from Pakistan and Kashmir, they have the balls enough to write up a new map and then, you know, throw it out all over Twitter and whatnot, say this is a new... What is happening with that stuff?
Look, actually, there is nothing new about that. Pakistan has been doing this for some time now. Kashmir has been at the heart of Pakistani politics since 1947. It became part of its politics because, if you remember, in 1947, just when Pakistan was created, Pakistani army had the audacity to send not just tribal raiders to Kashmir, to invade Kashmir, but also Pakistani army men to invade Kashmir in civvies, you know. So as we know, you know, as Ambassador Hussain Haqqani, who was Pakistan's ambassador to the US earlier, as he says that Pakistan is essentially an army which got territory out of India. So it was Pakistani army that, you know, that had the audacity to attempt invasion of Jammu and Kashmir in 1947. So Kashmir became entered into the consciousness of Pakistanis at the very beginning of their creation. In fact, many authors in Pakistan have said that you know, Pakistan is an acronym, and K is meant for Kashmir, because they saw, since Jammu and Kashmir was a Muslim majority state in 1947 and even now, that J&K should have been part of Pakistan. So whether it was Jinnah, whether it was Liaquat Ali Khan, whether it was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who went to the UN and made a very ferocious and passionate speech on Kashmir back then when he was leading the country. Even Benazir Bhutto, the liberal in Pakistan, she called Kashmir Pakistan's the jugular vein, you know. So from the left to the right in Pakistan, there is a consensus on Kashmir, unlike in India, that unlike in India, the left in India has been that, no, let's grant greater autonomy to Jammu and Kashmir. The loony left is like, let's grant independence to Jammu and Kashmir. And then there are Islamists within Jammu and Kashmir. No, let's you know, separate from India and become part of Pakistan. So India has accommodated all kinds of views on Kashmir. In Pakistan, from the left to the right, there is a complete consensus that Kashmir is the jugular vein of Pakistan because it's Muslim. It is right. It is the call of Islam to wrest them from India.
Right. How tired are you? Because we've been at it for a while.
I'm okay. I can speak.
I have one more question.
But I'm just wondering that how long...
is the conversation going to be?
I suppose you will. Yeah, I mean, I hope. I don't think people watch long conversations.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. And yeah? People like you, they definitely. Yeah? I am. One of the biggest shocks to me was, and this is something that I'd wanted to discuss with you as well. I get people like you. I get people like Abhijit. I don't know if you've heard of this gentleman. His name is J. Sai Deepak. I get people like people who are talking about, let's say, the Indic politics, this new emergent phenomena, this post-2014 era that you're talking. Yeah. And the curiosity with people, with kids, with 18, 19-year-olds is insane. Yeah. Because all of us feel a sentiment that probably you and I and Abhijit and all these other gentlemen that I mentioned are trying to articulate. It's we're going through a phase of self-recognition as a nation. Yeah. And it is great that alternate media of this nature is emerging as we do it, because renegades like me can give it a shot and, you know, hopefully articulate the sentiment for so many others. So you'd be surprised. Once I release this episode, do check the YouTube comments and you'll see people having such articulate, nuanced counterpoints to what you said and what I have said. It's insane. But here's my last question and then I'll let you go. I have troubled you on the Sunday evening enough. Yeah. My question is, and I tried to get this question out with Abhijit as well. I don't know how we never got to it. Abhijit is a sweet talker. He took me around. My question is, what is happening with China now becoming such an active part of this Kashmir narrative as well? Like, what the hell? It suddenly is now more important on the Kashmir-Ladakh front, more so than Kashmir front, but Ladakh front, than Pakistan is. What changed so suddenly, and what do we make sense of this in the future?
Okay, so I think people have this misconception that something changed suddenly. Actually, if you were following geopolitics of the region, and if you were following Kashmir, you would know that China has been a player for the longest time. In fact, you know, Aksai Chin, which is part of which was part of the erstwhile state of Jammu and Kashmir, China has its eyes set on JNK for a long time. Now, why this people think that this is certain, but it is not. To begin with, you have to take into consideration Xi Jinping's BRI, you know, Belt Road Initiative.
Oh, Belt Road Initiative, right.
Yeah. And you have to take into account the CPEC, China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Now, where does this come from? China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, it comes from actually the Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, the Gilgit-Baltistan, that corridor starts from there and goes down to up to Balochistan to access the sea. And, you know, when we say Pakistan-occupied Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan, that again is part of the erstwhile state of Jammu and Kashmir.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, President Donald Trump is, I think, he became the key to this whole issue that has emerged in the region. Until Trump came in power in the US, there was a certain, you know, balance in the region, in the sense that India, obviously, you know, India is not as big and as powerful as China. Hmm. That everyone, you know, knows. So India had this notion and this recognition that we cannot fight China, right? So we should be friends with China. And China also has had the backing of the US for a very, very long time. In fact, it was under Deng that the US became US allowed China opening up, and China became part of WTO. And also the fact that, you know, China was the biggest exporter to the US. So you, from US to the rest of the world, everyone has been dependent on China in the last 30 years, right? So India obviously, you know, didn't want to mess up, you know, with China. So India also decided that, you know, India cannot fight a two-front war with, you know, Pakistan on one side and China on the other side. Even though both are aggressors, both have occupied land in Jammu and Kashmir, and China has certain border issues in Arunachal Pradesh and Sikkim. So given that scenario, India made peace overtures, and India has been, as we call, frenemy of China. Hmm. We have been going along despite the fact that 1962 was a bitter experience, but India and China were okay. Hmm. Now, President Trump comes along and he realizes that something needs to be done about China's expansionism and China's imperialism, which is which has made inroads into third world countries rapidly. It has made inroads into Africa. It has made inroads into Middle East. It has made inroads into Europe, and it has made inroads into Asia as well, right? And this was all right, I would say, till President Obama was there. But a major section in the US, of course, did not benefit from the globalization mantra that the US sold to the world. And China also bought it, and China was also selling the whole idea, despite being a communist state. That section in the US created obviously a lot of resentment within the US that, you know, jobs were going to Indians, jobs were going to Chinese, and China has a huge edge over the US because China was amassing the largest US reserves in the world.
Hmm.
So Trump decided that, you know, that he's going to reverse this, because he wants jobs back in the US. He wants less dependence on China. He doesn't even want, you know, a lot of Indians there. And he's very honest and straightforward about that. So he decided, you know, that he will play a different policy altogether. Now India also realized that that when you have Pakistan on the one hand and you have China on the other hand, and India's own political landscape changed after 2014. Prime Minister Modi initially was trying to make friends with everyone, you know, except for Pakistan, and which was fine, again with the thinking that India can fight only one front war. But India's economy has been growing. India has been making progress, no matter, you know, what the cynics say and what the naysayers say. Yeah. But India is progressing. Now, with Prime Minister Modi in power, President Trump in power, and Xi Jinping in power, something has to give, because Trump and Xi Jinping are not on the same page. Mm. Trump is challenging Xi Jinping. He is challenging his worldview. He is challenging his dominance. He is challenging his ambition, which is to rule the world, which is, you know, to declare China as the most powerful country in the world. Mm. And India had to pick sides. Mm. Because because President Trump is clear about it, that either you choose to be with us or you are with China. Like, you know, George Bush gave the ultimatum to the world, that either you are with the US or you are with the terrorists. So President Trump has given a similar ultimatum to the world. Either you are with us or you are with China. I think India has made a choice. India has picked the US. And that is what has agitated China a lot, because China sees that India is willing to play ball with the US to contain China, to contain China's supremacy in the region, not only in the region, but overall world. And that is why we see China needling India on every front. So it's essentially the choice India has made. I don't want to, you know, go into specifics, but this is my analysis of the situation.
And is this what Trump offered to this extent, choose, was this public, or was this like a diplomatic message that was sent across to other countries? Or what did he say that publicly? You were either...
No. There is no... So I said this is my analysis.
This is your analysis.
This is my analysis. I don't think President Trump has given an ultimatum. But if you look at all the statements President Trump has made, the fact that President Trump declared a trade war with China, mm-hmm, after coming to power, that had never happened before. Trade war with China, you know, renegotiating terms with China, then challenging China on South China Sea. The Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's statements after statement saying that we tried every reasonable approach with China. We were happy with their progress, and we thought that as China grows economically, it will become more democratic. But the reverse has happened with China. As it became bigger economically, as it became a bigger power economically, it became more imperialistic. It has become more expansionist. It is tying the whole world in such, you know, for example, CPEC or BRI, for example. These are projects through which China is holding countries to ransom, you know. So China's expansionism is visible, and that is why President Trump has taken a tough stand against China. We heard clear statements after the coronavirus pandemic, which originated in Wuhan and which China tried to cover up. We saw President Trump calling it Chinese virus.
Still.
So, yeah. So there have been, President Trump may not have said that you are either with us or with China, but he has made it clear to the world that China is an adversary. China is not America's friend anymore. Right. I mean, even today, the US presidential elections are being fought on this debate.
Absolutely. I expect the China rhetoric to skyrocket over the next few months, given that Biden's sort of taking the lead. And I mean, the presidential elections in the United States have become some sort of a reality TV contest, and it's pretty hilarious to watch, especially when it does not directly affect you. But Aarti, thank you so much. You've been so kind. I have learned so much. This has been absolutely one of the best conversations I've had up until.
Thank you so much.
Do you have any questions for me?
No, I mean, I think my joy is now really.
I can imagine. This was probably one of the conversations I spoke the least in. I just had to ask you a question and you tell wonderful stories, and I had the best time.
Thank you so much.
All right.
It was nice talking to you. I hope I answered all your questions, and I hope people find this long, winding conversation fruitful and meaningful to them.
Oh, we'll see the YouTube comments on that. We'll definitely see the YouTube comments on that.